This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
Good morning. And it's a little bit drier this morning. What a storm last night. Hope you guys are okay after that incredible weather. It's the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show, and I'm chatting with Dr. Fahiza Patel. Doc, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks, Nicholas, for having me as usual, and to the team for always putting together such an amazing show.
Oh, thank you so much. Listen, it's all the team. I've got nothing to do with it. I'm just the voice and the face of the radio station. Face for radio, much better idea. So, Doc, World AIDS Day, and let's chat, kick it off about where are we in South Africa in terms of HIV and HIV stats?
So, I mean, we've had many, many years of HIV knowledge and experience, and we've been through some rough times before, and this year has been a particularly tough time for those of us who work on the ground with patients who are living with HIV, mostly because of challenges outside of our control. And
that's something I want to touch on as well. Sorry to interrupt.
Absolutely. You know, continues to be a learning experience and continues to be a struggle. But this year we learned that as South Africans, we are strong and we are resilient. We've been through some tough times before, and this is just another one of those things that we need to deal with. We take a different stance, pivot to a different way of doing things. And despite all the challenges we've had this year, we've made massive inroads into controlling HIV and in the very, very near future, preventing HIV in people who are not living with HIV but are at high risk.
I think, and that's such a vital point. I think just to go back sort of to the beginning of what you said, South Africa has been dealing with AIDS and HIV for a very long time. And I think our expertise in country is world class. I don't want to get into trouble here, but perhaps the best in the world for what we have on the ground. And I think from across the board, from the sisters working face-to-face with patients, caregivers, all the way up to the incredible research teams, we really are at the forefront because we were forced there, not by choice. In your experience working in the field, and it's a difficult question to ask, so I also do want to get into the sort of the funding being cut by the US and the effects that that has had. I know speaking to people that work in this field, some of them have lost their jobs and, are really, and you don't go into this field because you're there to make big money. You go into this field because you care for people and you want to enhance the quality of people's lives, and that opportunity gets taken away. And also, what has that impact been on sort of the healthcare workers' mindset and sort of their own sense of being? That's something I want to touch on a little bit later in the show. But I think just to start off, sort of where are we? Are things getting better? Is it more control? Have you seen since the funding's been cut that there's been an increase? What are we looking like in terms of sort of our HIV stats?
So, you know, we're planning on reaching the target for 2030, which is the UN AIDS goals, which are 95% of patients knowing their HIV status and 95% of people who are living with HIV having access to and being on ARVs. And of those, 95% of people who are on ARVs are supposed to have viral suppression, which means they are very well controlled on their ARVs. And we're at a stage now where we've got very robust ARV regimens, and not just for adults, for children as well. We've done a lot of work in trying to make those particular regimens more palatable and easier for children to be able to take as well. So all the way down to newborns are now being able to take those very robust ARV regimens, which assist massively in controlling the HIV viral load and in doing that very quickly. And it's a once daily tablet, so it makes life a lot easier than it used to be a few years ago. So in that scheme of things, we are doing a great job, but they are, as we've seen, a small gap in trying to reach those goals. And our health minister has been doing a massive campaign the last few months in order to find those missing individuals, to test them and to treat them and to get them virally suppressed. And I think it makes a massive impact when our politicians and our higher health education management teams are out there and promoting this very important space in which we can then use that as platforms to engage with people, to educate people, to spread messages within communities via community healthcare workers and NGOs, et cetera, and a lot of media interaction as well, whether that's on radio or TV or social media, for example. These are very important platforms, especially for us to be engaging on the same level as the youth, who are always at high risk of not knowing the importance of testing and treatment and the co-infections that can occur with HIV.
I think that on that point of social media and with the youth, because youth are always on social media, are you seeing a greater reach with the use of social media? Would you like to see more social media use in terms of getting in front of the youth?
Yes, and I think this is a very important part to focus on. And I think that we acknowledge that this is something that the youth don't want to listen necessarily to the traditional way of getting information. TikTok and other social media platforms that are much more fun for them are the ways that we should be going to ensure that they're getting the correct information. And that is very important. And there's the power of a social media celebrity is quite something. To be able to reach, thousands of followers from one social media post is quite a feat, especially when you're targeting the right audience with the right information. And at this point in time, it's, not just targeting females who are potentially at high risk of getting HIV or falling pregnant, but it's a holistic approach. And if you don't, and if you're not educating the male as well, then you're losing out on an opportunity because this is not a one-sided affair. This is the kind of thing that affects everybody. And everybody should be aware of it, in order not just to be tested and treated, but also to support each other through the processes.
Absolutely. And I suppose you have HIV awareness, social influences, it can have a massive impact because it's a message then that's respected and heard by the youth, those listening to it on social media, as opposed to the traditional method of, posters and talks and billboards and that type of thing, where they may be a little bit more ignored. What I wanted to touch on, and we're just moving towards our ad break time, but just on where we are now since the funding got cut. It's been a while. I wanted to find out from you in the healthcare community, what was the sense when you heard funding's going to be cut, and then now where we sit, where you're starting to see the consequences of that funding cut, and how serious has it been?
Yeah, so I mean, the funding cut came at a rather rapid pace, and a little bit unexpected, and caused quite a bit of disruption on the ground within government and within the sort of local city of Joburg or province level facilities as well. But I think that everyone rallied together relatively quickly. We had a good understanding of where the gaps were. I must say, we've always, as a South African government, been pretty good at making sure that we have access to the drugs. So the challenges with the loss of funding resulted in the loss of staff, most of all. And the staff that were lost were primarily the tiers of staff that help us collect the data, and be able to track participants, for example, and to some level, the nurses as well. But the supporting partners that helped the government were particularly affected. They have now managed to potentially find additional funding or had to retrench a large number of people and have pivoted to a point where smaller staff numbers are having to pick up large amounts of work. But I think that, as you said before, we're the kind of people who do this with passion and heart, not for the money. Mm-hmm. And so we pick up what we need to pick up as best as we can, and focusing on small chunks of problems rather than a big problem, breaking it down in prioritizing. And taking it one step at a time. We all have the same goal in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And looking forward, like I said, South Africans are great at picking ourselves up and dusting ourselves off and moving along to better spaces. So we are, I think we've all found ourselves this year in a tough year, but I think the end of the year has brought a refreshed feeling of positivity for 2026.
There, we are called South Africans, not South Afrikaans. And I think we're definitely a very resilient and tenacious people. What I wanted to ask, and hope we'll have a little bit of time before ads, what is the mindset been in the sense? Because it's an incredibly stressful field for the healthcare workers. And how has that sense been post the funding cut? Have people sort of just, again, pulled together and say, well, it's something else that we have to deal with and we're going to knuckle down? Was there a bit of a stress and pressure around that? And I think if we could get that answered when we're back from our ads, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, really from the point of view of how are our healthcare workers doing.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
Thank you so much for joining us for today's Dis-Chem Medical Monday show. My name is Nicholas Ingle, and I'm joined by Dr. Faiza Patel, clinical scientist renowned for her work in pediatric HIV optimization, TB, COVID vaccine research, and maternal health. I love that intro, and it's always awesome to chat with you, Doc. From a personal point of view, I wonder, how are our healthcare workers doing?
I think they're all doing much better now. I think the first 6 months after the funding cut was just covered in confusion. There wasn't a lot of information coming through, and people were still scrambling to get all their ducks in a row. And in that constantly changing environment, it was very difficult to know what the way forward was. But I think it's settled now. Mm-hmm. We're fully aware that we need to be self-sufficient, and that we need to actually engage with partners locally in order to be able to fund what are essentially our problems.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't necessarily rely on people from across the pond for anything that they don't see as their issue. And I think for us to engage both at a level that is in the private sector as well as the public sector, and the cross collaboration between the private and public sector, is fundamental for us to be able to do what is socially, morally correct.
Yes.
For us to do what is best for our communities, and to be able to engage on various levels, whether it be in boardrooms or whether it be at clinic spaces, where actually it's really quite something to be able to show individuals who usually live in boardrooms what clinics actually look like. And we've had a number of individuals coming through to visit VITS RHI, for example, and other research units within VITS over the last little while, because the G20 was occurring, and a lot of health ministers and other politicians and CEOs of big pharmaceutical companies have come through to see what it is we do. And for them to get an idea of the scope of the work we do and the communities that our work impacts makes a massive difference in terms of getting more support and building those relationships to be able to continue the work that we do.
Sure, that's absolutely phenomenal. What have the reactions been from sort of the CEOs and the health ministers coming through? I'm looking forward to hearing how shocked they were and how surprised by how awesome you are.
Yeah, but they're just amazed. They're amazed at the people that we help, the communities that we support. They're amazed at the amount of people who are willing to get involved in research from our local communities and to be able to feel like they're actually giving back to the world by taking part in studies that are then going to change guidelines or policies or improve the access to different forms of medication to people all over the world. And then they're very, very fascinated to see the teams on the ground, because these are the teams that pull through all the hard times and take it, despite all the knocks. Every day we're here, we do what we need to do. We pick ourselves up, we find alternate ways of doing things, and we find ways in which, at this point in time, technology and AI needs to be included in everything. And so we have to move with the times to be able to be competitive and to be able to do better for our communities and our country as a whole.
I want to touch on sort of the communities, how that work is going and what is being done there. But you mentioned AI, and just to go into that, how is the integration of AI being used? I was very fortunate to have a gentleman on my show, Jim Carroll, who's a futurist and an AI expert, but AI much further down the line as well. In terms of, for medical, the data processing and the ability to just deal with lots and lots of data. How are you finding it? Is it helping? Is it something that you want to integrate more?
Yeah, so we're doing a lot of work with individuals who work with AI, so they tend to know this part better than us clinicians.
And radio presenters as well.
We're learning a language that's way beyond us. But it is something that has to be integrated into systems, especially when you're resource limited. And the AI systems and computer systems, digital health systems, can support in so many ways that cover the very basics and are able to integrate data quickly. So this is something that we've been building on. We have quite a few partnerships with people who already have digital setups and AI setups within government and outside of that to be able to support some of this work, whether it's around HIV, whether it's around TB, whether it's around recruitment of participants for studies, or whether it's around education for patients at all levels.
Right.
And the National Department of Health actually has quite a few digital platforms that are supportive of all of this. And that also includes teaching and training of the nurses at the facilities. Because one of the things with a very restrained staffing component is that they don't get time to go out for training. There's one nurse running a clinic. She's never going to get a chance to go out for training. And so if we do sort of short WhatsApp videos or short interactive WhatsApp trainings or some sort of AI system via an app, and she can do that for 5 minutes or 10 minutes every day, just as a reminder for something important or to learn something completely new, that's the way to go, because we have to monopolize on the opportunities.
And what I'm hearing as well is a tremendous sensitivity and an understanding of those in the field and the limitations that they have in terms of time and transport and access. Because the sense I always get when chatting to you is that it is very much a team effort, all pulling together, all working together, but also like a team that's known one another for a very long time. And you know sort of the different points with the different people and how to work with them, which is absolutely wonderful. To go back a little bit, with the CEO visits and the visits from the G20s, was there further commitment in terms of additional support, whether it's financial or logistics or research, sort of along those lines?
Yeah, so, there's a lot of interaction at quite high levels. Professor Helen Rees is the director, executive director of BITS-RHI, and her work spans many, many different boards, and she is quite quite good at being able to tap into all of these systems and make them work together. So we are always having individuals coming around who are then either supporting by bringing in new studies or bringing in ideas that are going to be able to be much more user-friendly and bring a lot of support to our spaces. This is always, but it's also always good for us to be able to give feedback to them on things that they have potentially done. So it's always a two-way street. We give them good feedback in terms of what potentially doesn't work in our sort of setting, and especially when they're coming from a first world space and don't necessarily understand the challenges of not having electricity or having water cuts, etc. And those sorts of things actually are fundamental to how we do rollout and implementation on the ground.
Right.
So there's always commitment at some level, but there's always prioritization as well. So what we may want to do right now may not be priority for all. But if we continue our fight and continue keeping all of those things on the agenda and talking about it, they become priority at some point. And that's across the board at all levels.
It's just reminding those that needed to be reminded that something is a priority, the constant reminding and keeping them sort of, just keep poking them. I think that's the word I'm looking for, that it is a priority, because I think people are busy. There's a lot of demand on resources and on time. So constant reminding is always a good thing. Reminding or nagging, but no.
It's a fine line.
it's a fine line. It's a wonderful balance. In terms of the practicalities of the system, what are the different services that are available to the community? So if we're looking at people in terms of awareness and then those living with HIV, in terms of creating awareness and then supporting those living with HIV in the different communities, if we look at rural and then small towns and cities as an example.
Yeah, so we're always aware of the disparity between what happens in rural spaces versus what happens in urban or semi-urban spaces. But I think the use of social media has bridged that gap quite significantly. One of the other components that is very important is the use of lenacapavir, which is coming through to South Africa very soon. Some of our surrounding neighbors have already received stock, and we're just waiting for that last push before that arrives. And that will be soon. And that's quite a big step forward, firstly, because we've contributed a lot of South African data to those studies, which means that we know those injections work in our communities. It's not pulling data from other countries. And with having that stock and being able to do the training on the ground for the nurses, which the teams both within WITS RHI, which is something our implementation science team has supported at National Department of Health, to be able to do that work, to show that the rollout can work and to be able to do it effectively and efficiently. So that's a very big component for prevention. And I think that the information that has been out there on the rollout in lenacapavir and the option for an injectable that's every 6 months has been very good. And in terms of when it comes to treatment is also very important. And I think our health minister has done a great job of supporting the treatment component in the last little while, specifically going out on the roadshows for meeting those goals and for finding those the missing gap, as we talk about on a regular basis. And those two components together are very important, because the prevention drops your numbers of HIV-infected individuals, and those that are on treatment have viral suppression, and therefore the transmission rates drop. And it's not just the transmission rates from adult to adult, but also from moms to babies. And right. We've done a great job of doing that.
It's absolutely mind-blowing for me, because I grew up with HIV. One of our teachers in high school, I think in 1984, or 85 at the very beginning was HIV positive, and we were exposed to that very early on. And then, you know, going through the era of no treatment available through to the early ARVs and the impact that that had on people's health and the complications in taking it, the development through to where we are today, where you're talking about one injection every 6 months, it's kind of hard to comprehend. What's that been like for you working in the field, seeing these incredible, incredible processes? And, you know, this is also where I get frustrated, where people talk about sort of, you know, vaccines and stuff where, oh, it's so bad, you must. It's like, are you joking? Like, do you understand the life-changing differences that it absolutely makes? You know, it's not even just taking the medication or the side effects that it can have, but it's the fact that if you are in a job where you're having to leave at 4 a.m. and you're getting home at 11 o'clock at night, you know, your time is so limited. Then you're still having to prepare food for your family and wash and cook, where your time is so limited, where something that is so freeing in terms of time is literally life-saving. So I'd just love to get your thoughts on the progress of where we've come from and what that's been like to be part of it.
I mean, that's exactly it. It's been amazing. So for the last, I think, 15 years, I've been involved in doing research and treating patients with HIV. And at some point, we were seeing children specifically getting severely ill and being born with HIV and having many complications, especially related to their neurodevelopment. So they didn't speak well, they didn't walk well, they didn't do what other children were doing, they struggled at school, etc. And now, you know, I'm at a point where these kids look like all the other kids. There's nothing that makes you say, oh, look, that child potentially has something that makes you think he's got HIV. And this, what they say is, it makes me feel normal. And it makes me feel like I'm not different in any way. And a couple of kids that we've got on some of our studies that are sort of around the ages of 9, 10, going up to teenagers, have all said that. I don't now have to feel like I can't go and camp with my friends because I have to take medication every day. And I don't feel like I don't want to be able to go for a job interview because they're going to ask me, do I take medication and what are my chronic illnesses? And it's just the things that others take for granted. So these are the simple things in life that make a massive difference to the lifestyle of a patient and how they feel about themselves. Sure. And giving them that confidence to be able to say, listen, if I get one injection, for example, every 8 weeks, as we do for CAB and rilpivirine for children, and no one needs to know that I take medication, and I can go in for an injection, get that done every 8 weeks and continue with the rest of my life as if nothing ever happened. That's amazing. Just to be able to give someone that opportunity. I mean, it doesn't work for everyone. Someone won't want injections and someone will prefer. But having that option to be able to do it in different ways to suit your lifestyle is fundamental to making people more confident in just the way that they're able to represent themselves.
And then the willingness to take the treatment as well.
Yes.
You know, it's amazing. And it's just it's not only the longevity, but it's the quality of that life, which is absolutely incredible, absolutely amazing. I've got a big smile on my face here, which is really cool. But I suppose also the thing to consider is, you know, obviously you need to prevent first, but all of this wonderful work that's being done in order to enhance quality of life that we need to take into account. We're going to go to ad breaks, Doc. When we come back, I'd like to chat to you about what people need to do to prevent transmission. I know it's something that we should all know and it's common sense, but again, about being reminded, what are the steps that people need to be taking? What do they need to be cautious of? We'll get onto that straight after these ad breaks. You're listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday Show here on 101.9 High FM. My name is Nicholas Ingle, and I'm chatting with the epic Dr. Faiza Patel. Let us have your questions for the doc on our WhatsApp number 061-895-1019.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dis-Chem. Better health starts here.
And welcome back to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday Show here on 101.9 High FM. I'm Nicholas Ingle, and I'm chatting with Dr. Faiza Patel. Yep, Doc, you are epic. Have to tell you that because, you know, there are many things in South Africa for us to be proud of, not just mentioning the Springboks performance on the weekend, but also I think of our incredible medical teams and the research that's being done and the professionalism and the care across the board, from those on the ground all the way to those in the lab and to those who or administrators and at the top of the sort of the admin pile, as it were. So very grateful. What are some of the processes that need to be followed in terms of prevention of HIV transmission?
I think the basics are always fundamental to keep in mind. And that's like minimizing risky sexual behavior is always the first one, you know. If you're trying to stay in a committed relationship and not have multiple sexual partners, that's always step one. And I think that's a difficult space. There's a lot of social norms and things that make that slightly more complicated. But I think having that as a basis is always a great start. And then condoms, I can't say enough about condoms. You know, people are forgetting about condom use, because they think there are other options available. Mm. So why should I do that? And it's also sometimes culturally unacceptable for use of condoms. But I think that is a very important barrier to use. Not just for preventing pregnancy, it's not foolproof, but helps prevent pregnancy and also for prevention of other sexually transmitted diseases. Now, HIV is one of them. There are many others. And having another sexually transmitted disease ultimately does increase your risk of getting HIV. So it's a multi-pronged approach to doing this. And then obviously, if you think you're in a very high risk environment or in a relationship or having multiple sexual partners in any way that you think your risk is higher, then there are options out there. And the two options that are going to be available at this point in time are going to be the oral tablet, which is Truvada. And that's two ARVs, that is in one pill. And that is a formal rollout that has occurred, and those drugs are available and quite easily accessible. The clinics are able to dispense this at a nurse level, not necessarily a doctor level. And we do this even in pregnant women too, because you don't want a pregnant woman to fall pregnant being HIV negative and then catch HIV while she's pregnant, because that's a very high risk patient. So we do try to make sure that they are having access to prevention, whether that's oral or injectable. There are other options like the dapivirine ring. It is not as efficient and effective as the lenacapavir, which is about to be rolled out. So that's going to be the next option, is to be able to get lenacapavir as prevention, as a 6-monthly injection. And the studies that we've done have shown great efficiency in being able to give those particular drugs, as well as great effectiveness against preventing HIV.
Right.
So these are all options that are available, but a lot of it is something that has to be done in a relatively structured way, because, you know, you have to make sure you're getting your regular doses of medication and that someone is giving it correctly. Once all of those platforms are up and running, I am sure that the access will be quite quick, because this is something we're pushing for on all levels, and that includes that Department of Health.
And I just wanted to also touch on what you mentioned of risky behavior. And just to maybe stress the point that risky behavior doesn't mean that risky behavior is a lifestyle, that you're always taking chances and you're not looking after yourself. It can be in an instant and it can be within a moment. And what I'd like to maybe go into and just get your thoughts on is, you know, we're coming up to December, it's going to be school holidays, a lot of the matrics are going away on rage, there's going to be a lot of alcohol consumption, a lot of drug use, unfortunately. And, you know, for someone, I've been sober for 19 years, so I understand very well that the more alcohol you consume, the more you give away your ability to protect yourself. So for every drink that you have, you're giving away your ability to be aware of your situations, aware of your circumstances and surroundings, and your ability to keep yourself safer. Speaking to perhaps the matrix and the young people that are going away on holiday, from your experience, that one moment in a night can change your life forever. I'd just like your thoughts on that as to some of the real risks behind alcohol consumption and drug consumption, you know, on holiday.
Yeah, you know, I mean, any disinhibition that can occur, whether you're specifically as a youngster, where you're not emotionally mature enough just yet, those are all opportunities at which any of these things can occur. You know, sex with an individual you've just met, or even someone you've known for a long period of time, and it's just an event that occurs. And I think what is important is for everyone to know that these things will happen, hopefully in small numbers, but that there are options available, and seeking care as early as possible is always a great idea. So even if it's the next day, for example, seeking healthcare at a clinic or a private doctor, or even going to the pharmacist, who can then potentially guide you further as to what to do. So there are ways in which you can potentially decide to do an early pregnancy test, or to do an early termination of pregnancy, should that be something that you opt to do, or whether it's testing for HIV and taking prophylaxis post-exposure, or whether it's making sure that you don't have an STI post your interaction. Though you have to at some point take responsibility for your action and then make sure that you are caring for yourself. Because if you don't seek the attention that you need, the attention is not going to come towards you. So you must make sure that you actually take the responsibility, knowing what had occurred. Sometimes it is difficult, because then you have to say that you have done something that someone is going to potentially judge you for. But even knowing that, to be able to seek the attention from a healthcare worker, who in our space, we try to be as non-judgmental as possible. The aim is not to be stigmatizing. The aim is to get the appropriate care for the patient. And so if everyone keeps that in mind, you know, it will make it easier to be able to attend a healthcare facility.
And I think it's, from the my understanding is, first rule, don't. If you do, then make sure you get these processes followed as quickly as possible, whether that's a clinic or a doctor or a pharmacist. You're not going to be judged. But just make sure that if it's a, you know, something that happens as a one-off event, don't let it affect the rest of your life. We're going to go to ads, Doc, and then when I come back, I'd like to get your thoughts on, is there something that you would like to say to your fellow healthcare professionals, those in the field, those in the lab? And I'd just like to get your thoughts on that. So we'll touch on that straight after these ads. You're listening to the Disco Medical Monday show here on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Nicholas Ingle. Let's go to ads.
This is Medical Monday, brought to you with the compliments of Dischem. Better health starts here.
And we are back. Thank you so much for joining us. Doc, just before we went to ad break, and we have new chairs in the studio, and I happened to pull on a handle just before we went on the mic and had that sinking feeling. That's why I disappeared there for a second. Sorry about that. What would you like to say to your fellow healthcare workers from those facing people in the communities to in the lab to sort of the administrators. You know, I think our sports heroes get so much glory, but I think some glory needs to be shared and shone here as well.
I think just a massive thank you to the resilience and to the forward-thinking behavior that we have, and for not letting things get us down, and if they get us down for a very short period of time. I think always for thinking out the box and for collaboration, which I've seen a lot of this year. I think we got to a point where at some point we were isolated silos of research units and partners supporting Department of Health in various places. And this year, everyone learned that if we don't talk to each other and work together, we're going to each struggle individually. So the collaboration across the board, whether it's across your research sites, across universities, partners helping Department of Health, and actually the Department of Health in each province, have come together to have open conversations about what is working well in some provinces and not working well in others. And I think that open communication, it has gone a long way to getting us to a point in the end of 2025 where we're feeling comfortable with all of the work we've done for the year.
Absolutely phenomenal. One last question just before we wrap up, Doc. What is exciting you about the future within the research, within the treatment? What's exciting you?
So two very exciting things, specifically in the maternal and child and TB HIV world, is the M72 TB vaccine study, which has been on for some time, but is showing some promise. And the idea of having an alternate TB vaccination to prevent TB in our high-risk settings is going to be a game changer. And so we're very excited about that particular study, and hopefully those results will be out in the near future. So that's one aspect that's very nice to be able to share and be a part of. The other study that I think is also going to be a game changer is a study that we're doing related to a respiratory syncytial virus. So that's a virus that makes newborn babies or babies in the first 6 months of life extremely ill. And it's a maternal vaccination that's given to mom within a specific time of her pregnancy that helps prevent the baby from getting severe RSV infections. And for various reasons, this is a massive game changer because it drops the amounts of kiddies that are then admitted to neonatal ICUs and pediatric ICUs, and decreases the time and effort and money that has to go into the treatment of these severe cases when we can just do maternal vaccinations and prevent such severe diseases, which do have long-term complications. So these are two very important studies that we're working on and that are going to be game changers going forward.
That's absolutely phenomenal. The research always amazes me, and I'm very grateful to be able to chat with you sort of almost every year, and just to get an understanding and see how things are moving, and things that we've spoken about coming out have now come out and having an impact on people's lives. It's really, really incredible. Doc, thank you so much to you and your team, and to everyone in the healthcare space that's dealing with this, and just treating patients with kindness and compassion, and, you know, to training family support members so that they can look after their loved ones at home. It's really enhanced the quality of life of so many South Africans and people around the world. You know, you can't even express to that extent. So from us, just a very big thank you to you and your team, Doc.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Nicholas, for having me and for the opportunity to be able to talk about all these exciting things.
I always get frustrated when we only have an hour, so I know we could go on a lot more. And thank you for joining us and for your time. And just, you know, keep shining the light, keep leading the way, and keep rocking it. It's absolutely awesome to see. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, and have a lovely festive season and New Year.
You too. Thank you. That's Dr. Faiza Patel, clinical scientist renowned for her work in pediatric HIV optimization, TB and COVID vaccine research, and maternal health. You've been listening to the Dis-Chem Medical Monday show here on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Nicholas Ingle, joined in studio by the epic Craig pushing all the buttons, my fantastic producer Sina, getting us wonderful guests like the doc. Thank you for being with us, and I look forward to chatting with you next week.